Good afternoon. I'm Allison Ruttenberg, representing William Hart. Mr. Hart was a sex offender who was on probation in Jefferson County. His probation was revoked when he was terminated from treatment, and he was terminated from treatment because he was in denial. He did not plead guilty in this case. There was a jury trial, and he was convicted contrary to his pleas, and he has continued to maintain his innocence ever since and continued to maintain his innocence during treatment. But we know that the treatment providers cannot and will not provide treatment to sex offenders who deny the indexed offenses. As part of his treatment, he was given a polygraph examination purportedly on whether he committed the index offense or not. And according to the polygrapher, Jeff Jenks of Amick and Jenks, when he denied committing that offense, his response was allegedly deceptive. As part of the probation revocation complaint, the district attorney indicated that, you know, she would be bringing in through hearsay all of these records in treatment, including these polygraph test results. So Mr. Hart exercised his right under the Lovell case to object to the second and third degree hearsay, in other words, objecting to the probation officer testifying as to what the treatment provider would say regarding what Jeff Jenks said, regarding what the results of the polygraph test result were, and asked that Mr. Jenks, if there was going to be testimony regarding the results of that polygraph, that Mr. Jenks testify himself so he could be cross-examined directly. For a variety of reasons, there never was a hearing actually on whether or not Mr. Hart violated his probation because, you know, as it turns out, he couldn't deny the fact that he violated the terms and conditions of his probation because he was terminated from offense-specific treatment with the sex offender treatment provider. So then the issue became whether the prosecution was entitled to tax to him as cost of the prosecution, Mr. Jenks' fee for appearing in court, for sitting in court for a couple of hours one morning without being called. The motion to exclude the polygraph examination results themselves are at page 137 of the electronic record, and that motion is based on the fact that to the extent that the prosecution was trying to establish that Mr. Hart was in fact guilty of the offenses that he was convicted of, they couldn't use the polygraph test results to get there. And it was an inappropriate piece of evidence in a probation revocation proceeding to seek to introduce that to begin with. And then, of course, after sentencing, the issue became whether the prosecution was allowed to then tax Mr. Jenks's $340 fee as a legitimate cost of prosecution. So the argument on that is threefold. First of all, his testimony was irrelevant to begin with and should have never been attempted to have been presented in the first place, whether directly through the treatment provider or through the probation officer. And then more importantly, he's not really a witness. He's not really an expert witness. The DA never endorsed him as an expert witness pursuant to Rule 702, never provided an expert report pursuant to 702. There's nothing in the record that she ever endorsed him as an expert witness. Instead, the district attorney's position seemed to be like, well, he's a professional, therefore he's an expert, therefore he's entitled to be paid as an expert. So,
Excuse me, Ms. Ruttenberg, let me ask you a question about the expert character of this particular witness. It wasn't the fact of the polygraph that was important here, but rather the results, whether the defendant was being deceptive or not. And so wouldn't there need to be someone who would have to testify about the results and their reliability and the scientific principles behind those in order to establish whether the defendant was being deceptive?
Yes, that's what the prosecution was going to, well, actually, the prosecution wasn't going to do that. The prosecution was just going to get in the test results as third degree hearsay through the probation officer. And then what I objected pursuant to the Lovell case, and they were going to call him, but she never endorsed him as an expert witness. There is no motion or no record made of the endorsement of Jeff Jenks as an expert witness. And I did cite some case law from other jurisdictions that you can really analogize Mr. Jenks to kind of a treating physician, like in a personal injury case, where the treating physician is still testifying as to expert conclusions, but that's really still an occurrence witness. It's not an expert witness under Rule 702. But even if Mr. Jenks could be properly characterized as an expert witness under 702, the prosecution never designated him as such. So after the fact, way after the fact, then the prosecution tried to characterize him as an expert witness in order to entitle them to recovery of Mr. Jenks' fees. And then I also argued that, well, even if we get that far, the district court should have held an evidentiary hearing as to whether Mr. Jenks' fees were reasonable. For example, he's trying to bill for 3 hours for just reviewing his report. His report was only 10 pages long. What was he doing for 3 hours? Also, was he really entitled to be paid his full, well, to begin with, what is his hourly rate? There's no evidence of what his hourly rate even is. Is it reasonable? Is it reasonable for him to bill $80 an hour? Or is he just billing $80 an hour because that's what the district attorney, that's the maximum amount per hour that the district attorney's office will pay any expert witness? But so there's the reasonableness of that fee, whether or not that's his actual hourly fee. I mean, does he bill everybody $80 an hour or just district attorneys who are willing to pay him $80 an hour? What was he doing for 3 hours that would justify 3 hours of expert witness time to review a 10-page report that he was already familiar with? And then also, was he entitled to bill the defendant for just sitting in the courtroom doing nothing and reviewing other cases at the full $80 an hour rate that he was charging? All of those were factual issues that we contend that the district court was required to hold an evidentiary hearing on. And you know, I did make mention in the opening brief, and I also made mention in the record that in other cases in Jefferson County, the district court judges take the opposite position, that in a probation revocation proceeding, especially in a sex offender case, when the prosecution is calling the treatment provider or a polygrapher to testify as to what happened during treatment of this individual, that is not an expert that was retained for the purpose of the probation revocation hearing, thus entitling the prosecution to reimbursement for expert witness costs. These were experts that were already retained by the state to treat this individual as part of sex offender treatment. And this is part of the duties of that witness to then come in and testify in court. And they are really more analogous to an occurrence witness, not an expert witness under 702, especially when the prosecution fails to designate and disclose them as expert witnesses prior to the hearing. So that's one of the reasons why we're asking for remand back to the district court, to either eliminate the $340 fee altogether or for an evidentiary hearing as to the reasonableness of Mr. Jenks' fee, if this court disagrees with me that Mr. Jenks is not even a valid expert witness to begin with, entitled to any type of expert compensation.
Could I ask a question? Sure. Sorry to interrupt. CJD 87-01 states that the hourly fee for expert witnesses shall not exceed $100 per hour. Is this presumptively reasonable under that directive?
Well, with all due respect, not without an evidentiary hearing. I mean, what does Mr. Jenks charge other clients? What was he going to do here that justifies an $80 an hour fee, especially when he's charging to spend 3 hours reviewing a 10-page report? That doesn't seem to be presumptively reasonable. I don't think that the district court can rule that it's presumptively reasonable without holding a hearing to find out what Mr. Jenks is charging other clients in other circumstances, and what his normal hourly fee is. Just because he can receive no more than $100 an hour, that doesn't mean that $80 an hour would be presumptively reasonable just because it's less than $100 an hour. And I just very briefly, let me touch on the first issue, and then I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. In this case, at the original sentencing hearing, and I was not the attorney at the original sentencing hearing, I only represented Mr. Hart during probation revocation proceedings. There was no determination made as to restitution. The district attorney asked to reserve that for 90 days. The district court granted that. The 90-day time period came and went. There was no request for any type of restitution, and then there was no finding regarding restitution on the minimus. And according to the Dunlap case, there cannot be a legal final appealable sentence until a determination as to restitution has been made. If restitution is zero, then that's the determination that needs to be made. But that was never determined by the district court in this case. And instead, at the second sentencing hearing, she just acknowledged my argument and then said, defense counsel can sort that out with the Court of Appeals. And
doesn't Sanoff say, sorry for interrupting, doesn't Sanoff say that you don't have, the court doesn't have to put the amount of the restitution on the minimus for it to be a final judgment, that can be saved until later?
It can be saved until later. It was saved until later in this case, but it was never actually addressed. At no time did the district court ever actually address the restitution
issue. But can the district court address that issue at any time?
Well, I would contend if she tried to address it 2 years later a year later at the probation revocation hearing, that was too late, that the district attorney had 90 days to submit her restitution paperwork and failed to do so, and therefore the district court would have had to order a zero amount of restitution. But not even that finding was made. The district court refused to make any type of finding whatsoever with respect to restitution. And therefore, it is our position under the Dunlap case that Mr. Hart does not yet have a legal sentence. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve my time for rebuttal.
You have just under 3 minutes.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Kathy Gillespie. I'm representing the people of the state of Colorado today, and my registration number is 26109. I want to start off and correct my opposing counsel. The expert was endorsed as a witness, and that's found at page 132 of the what I consider the flat file, but it was electronic file in this case. So he was endorsed as an expert before the hearing, the probation revocation hearing. The other statement was that there were a variety of reasons why there was no probation revocation hearing, and there was really just one reason, and that is in her opening statements to the probation revocation hearing, defense counsel admitted to the first two counts in the complaint, and when the trial court questioned her about whether or not there was a purpose to a probation revocation hearing at that point, she indicated that there was not, and the hearing was canceled, and the case was set over for sentencing. I think that the court in this case authorized $340 in cost of prosecution for the expert witness. Jenks was endorsed as an expert witness, was called to testify. 3 hours of prep time. While counsel says that was just to review reports, we don't know what the 3 hours were taken. And delving into that would also go into a lot of work product information between the DA and their witness. There could have been meetings with the DAs, there could have been phone calls, questions the DA was asking. I think the fact that the amount was $20 under the recommended amount in 1987, in 2014, would get a presumption of reasonableness, even if the statute required that. I think it's important to look at the plain language of that restitution statute. Says that it is the actual expert witness fees and not reasonable expert witness fees as it does in the civil context.
In light of the fact that we don't know what the prep time involved, is an evidentiary hearing advised or required?
No, it's not required. I don't think it's advised for a lot of the reasons that are stated in my brief, being that this would overtake the trial itself or the revocation hearing itself. I think the trial court could look at this, knew the posture of the case. The hearing, the complaint wasn't confessed until opening arguments. The motion objecting to Jentz's testimony wasn't filed until the morning of the hearing. I put in my brief the emails between Ms. Rettenberg and the DA regarding the continuation of a hearing demanding Mr. Jenks' presence in person, the conversations with Ms. Rettenberg about the fact that the defense was planning to hire their own expert witness to refute the polygrapher's statements. So I think that in the context of this case, and when defense objections were made and when admissions were made, many of these fees could have been avoided had there been notice to the trial court and the DA that there wasn't going to be any challenge to the probation revocation complaint.
Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay.
We talk about reasonableness in the civil context, but the amount is a question of fact. And if this expert would have spent 40 hours, we could say, well, that's actual expense. And we could say, I think that's probably not reasonable. I mean, I'm trying to figure out the distinction here. Would you agree that it's a question of fact?
It is a question of fact. And I think this court reviews under an abuse of discretion, looking at the reasonableness and arbitrariness of the trial courts.
In the absence of a hearing.
In the absence of a hearing. And I think that the trial court, knowing the facts of the case, how this case proceeded to hearing, and the minimal expenses that were incurred on the half hour of travel time and the 2 hours of wait time, waiting for the revocation hearing to start, I mean, the trial court's able, knows all of that information. The defense's argument that they should be able to get into what was reasonable and what wasn't isn't in the statute. It says actual expert witness fees incurred. I would agree with you, Judge, that there may be cases where, looking at the bill that's submitted, anyone would be able to tell that it was an unreasonable amount of time. But the cost of prosecution statute doesn't set a limit on the total number of costs, the total amount of costs that can be submitted by the prosecution. So I think that the posture of when all this was done, the fact that the trial court had all of that, I mean, the trial court knew whether or not there was a 2 hour delay before the expert getting there and the hearing taking place. And if you read the transcripts of the hearing, there was a lot of argument ahead of time, in addition to the DA proceeding through opening statements. And it wasn't until the defense attorney finished her opening statements that the trial court even had to inquire as to why they were there for the hearing. So I don't think that the civil context is relevant to the criminal. I think the legislature clearly included the word reasonable expert costs in the civil costs section and did not in the criminal. It says actual expert witness fees. The trial court did rule in granting the motion for costs that had this proceeded to trial, he would have admitted that information, Jenks' testimony, not so much to show, I think, the accuracy of whether or not the defendant molested his granddaughter, but I think it would be whether or not he was progressing in treatment and whether or not that progression in treatment allowed him to get out of denial. And I cited a variety of out-of-state cases that have used polygraphy results in a probation revocation complaint situation, as opposed to that we all know they're not admissible at trial on the ultimate issue of guilt. Also, our cost statute does not require that the witness testify at trial. It could have been an expert that was simply helping or assisting the prosecution in preparing their case for trial. So I think the fact that the fees were reasonable or within the amounts outlined by the Chief Justice Directive some 15 years earlier, the fact that it was a minimal amount of cost, and the fact that most of that cost was incurred by defense counsel's delay in letting anyone know that they were objecting to the expert witness, the delay in admitting the two counts in the complaint. I mean, they admitted those in their opening statement, not after they heard testimony. I think it was an unreasonable amount to award to the prosecution in that case. I would point out on the restitution that really what the defense is litigating here is whether or not they have a right to directly appeal the underlying conviction in this case because there is no restitution. The restitution amount is zero. So there's really no reason to have a hearing on that amount. The trial court, in line with Sarnoff, reserved restitution. In his 35A ruling, the trial court said that it found liability for the defendant to be responsible for restitution. I would also point out to the court that a very basic appellate rule wasn't followed in this case. We have no transcript of the sentencing hearing where the court made these findings. I filed my brief using some pages of the transcript that were attached to a prosecutor's motion, but it's not a verified transcript. It's obviously not a complete transcript. So my first argument is this court doesn't even get to this issue because the defense didn't provide the appropriate record on appeal and didn't even address it in their reply brief when I raised it in my answer brief. Even if the court is comfortable using a partial, unverified transcript to make its ruling, Sarnoff and Dunlap dispose of the issue. The court considered restitution, gave the DA 60 days to file any amount that they wanted to request. That request was never filed because the victim and the Victim Compensation Board wasn't making a request for restitution. And at the trial court, the defense said the purpose of this was to be able to go back and litigate on direct appeal the conviction. And I think the cases and the case law from the Supreme Court guide this court's decision. I would also point out that at the probation revocation hearing when the restitution was discussed, defense counsel acknowledged that they never intended to file a direct appeal. I believe there's still 3 months left on the post-conviction time frame, but I think the case law out there indicates very clearly that there's no right at this point to go back on a direct appeal and challenge the underlying conviction. The relief was requested under 35A, which only gives the right to for this court or the trial court to reconsider sentencing. So essentially it's a request to go back and fix a clerical error. Should the trial court have gone back and put a zero on the minimus? Probably would have been a better course of action. But under the case law, that doesn't open up the direct appeal right. And really, other than that, that's really the only claim on appeal since there is no restitution being asked for. If the court doesn't have any other questions for me, that's all I have. Thank you.
First of all, the Attorney General is confusing Rule 35A with Rule 35B. 35B is a rule for sentence reconsideration. 35A just is not clerical errors, but also illegal sentences. Mr. Hart has an illegal sentence because restitution was never considered or ordered. Regarding the issue that there is no transcript of the actual sentencing hearing in the record, none is needed because on March 7, 2013, at page 28, lines 5 through 12, the court said, I was never given restitution, so the court has never ordered restitution in this matter. Everybody was in agreement at the second restitution hearing. The restitution was never taken up and considered at the first sentencing hearing.
Well, whether or not it was ordered, don't we need the sentencing transcript to know if it was considered?
She said she was never given restitution in this matter. It is clear from the March 7, 2013 transcript that restitution was never considered. I argued that at length and was shot down by the court by saying that she never considered it because the district attorney never provided her any restitution materials. And it is clear from the minute orders in this case that the district attorney was given 90 days to present restitution matters and never did so. Now, regarding this issue regarding the endorsement of the expert witness, yes, on February 7th, 2013, the DA filed a fatally deficient notice of endorsement of witnesses that did not comply with Rule 16. There was no CV attached. There was no expert report attached. And this endorsement was made 7 days after the hearing, after the January 30th, 2013 hearing that the Attorney General is complaining, where I asked for the continuance because of the issue regarding having a polygrapher be there in person. Prior to that time, there was no endorsement of the polygrapher. I didn't delay in doing anything. it was a district attorney that delayed in endorsing or attempting to endorse this expert witness on February 7th, and then 6 days later, I filed my motion to object. So the problem here is, though, that there was no compliance with Rule 16. There was no CV, there was no report. I was left to guess as to what this expert might testify to. I could assume that maybe he was going to testify regarding his 10-page report that he provided to the treatment provider. Now the Attorney General is arguing, well, maybe he, in that 3 hours that he was spending preparing, he was looking at all his other reports. Well, what other reports? No expert reports were ever attached to this February 7th, 2013 purported endorsement of an expert that doesn't comply with Rule 16. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.